Good evening, friends. Welcome to Valley Writers Read. I'm Franz Wenschenk, delighted to tell you that we're featuring a really superior author tonight. Her name? Liza Wieland. And the story she's going to read for us is entitled Tommy Waddell. I think you'll find it a very realistic story about two teenagers who find themselves very much attracted to each other. Here she is, Liza Whelan, reading Tommy Waddell.
There was a boy, a very strange, enchanted boy. They say he wandered very far over land and sea. A little shy and sad of eye, but very wise was he.
Tommy Waddell. My first boyfriend has a shirt with Norton Commando stitched over his heart. When I first see him, I wonder if that's his name, but he tells me it's the name of the motorcycle he'll have this time next year when he turns 16. He says he wants the kind you have to jumpstart. Norton Commando. I say it over to myself. I like the sound of that name, the way the words lick around inside and outside your mouth, like the first time you French kiss, and for a second you don't know if you're doing it right, but then you don't care, and you only want to keep doing it forever. When I picture him now, I'm looking over one of his shoulders, and I see his hands, brown and always warm, like he'd just been holding them over a fire. I see him leaning against a wall with his arms crossed high over his chest, four fingers tucked inside his armpits, thumbs hooked around, pointing straight up. He's wearing a cap that says Waddell Chevrolet. He's Tommy Waddell. Myself, I'm 13, nearly out of the seventh grade, and already a bit of a genius. It's the year I keep forgetting my math homework. It just slips my mind. And then we'll be trading papers to check answers, and I'll look across the aisle at Robert Kelly, whisper to him I don't have it again. I do a report on earthworms, and for the whole first page write mouse instead of worm. Geniuses are like that. They can only do one thing at a time, and they get distracted easily. I read all their biographies, Einstein, Newton, Shakespeare, Marie Curie, Thomas Edison, and they all talk about getting lost in their own hometowns, wherever they are, seeming like foreign territory. I know what they mean. When I get home from school every day, the first thing I have to do is lie down. My heart hurts so bad. Or else I have to walk around Lake Brookhaven, taking deep breaths, telling myself this is supposed to happen. I say the word heart, but I know it's growing pains. No one told me they would hurt this much, not even Noreen and Robbie Lynn, who've been having theirs for a year. At night in the dark, I touch my chest, and it feels like two bags of marbles, heavy and hard. I dream that a boy cuts me open, and all the marbles come spilling out, green and blue and yellow, cat's eyes, tiger eyes, and they swirl over the floor like pebbles at the end of a kaleidoscope, while the boy chases them and laughs. I'm so light I float above him, watching it all, feeling the breezes blow through the cuts in my chest. One Saturday in February, my mother and I go to the movies, and in the ladies' room I see I've started to bleed. It doesn't hurt, and even though I've read all the books and seen all the movies in health class, I still think it should feel like being pierced, like Saint Sebastian, who had 100 arrows in his body and a trickle of blood from every wound, or like a hand pulling at my insides, stripping off old layers of wallpaper in heaves and sighs. When I go back into the theater, the movie has already started, and I don't say anything to my mother. I watch the screen, but the images stop before they get into my eyes. My body's closed itself off. It's full, a hotel with no vacancies, only wanting more of itself. I'm too young to know these things, but I know them anyway. I know inside I'm a lush red garden tangled in vines, and all around me my own smell, the smell of that blood, is sweet, cloudy sweet in the air, like it might have come out of a flower. When I first see Tommy Waddell, he's down behind the boathouse on Lake Brookhaven. flat on his belly with one arm in the water, flush against the lake's bank. It's the end of March and warm, so he's taken his shirt off, and the skin on his back is the pearly white of places that have never been in the sun. He's tall and skinny, and I can see the backs of his ribs where they curve around him, his spine snaking roughly down his back and disappearing under the waistband of his jeans. He has an India ink tattoo on his far arm. I know it's not real because my brother Harry has one too, a star on his right shoulder. That first day, I don't get a good look at Tommy Waddell's tattoo because we don't know each other yet. But later I see it's a cutlass with an irregular curve to the blade. I like to run my finger along its edge and pretend that his skin could cut mine. His hair is blonde and straight, the kind that turns yellowy-green in the summer. It's hanging to his shoulders, falling forward almost into the water. He keeps trying to tuck it behind his ears. I see him before he sees me, and I know he isn't one of the neighborhood kids. I don't want to talk anyway, so I start to walk back up the hill. "Hey," his voice is the kind you turn around for. "Do you fish here?" "Sometimes," I say. We have bamboo poles hanging in the garage. In the summer, Harry goes fishing and then leaves the guts out for compost. Every time he does it, we talk about how fish don't bleed. "Bass or brim?" Tommy says. "Both. More bass, though. They're dumb, easier to catch." "You can tickle up the brim," he says. "That's what I'm doing. Watch." He starts to turn back toward the water, then waves me over with his free hand, without turning around, like he knows I'll come. You reach your arm down the bank, and you can get them right under the chin. He looks up at me. "Fish have chins," he says. I sit down on the heels of my sneakers, and he stretches out again on his belly. I watch the muscles and bones move across his back. His left shoulder blade shudders when all his weight shifts over to that arm. I can see how all the pieces of him are connected. "Have you caught any yet?" "No, I just got here." He turns his head like he's listening, but then speaks instead. "Do you live around here?" he says. "Up by the 11th green. Do you?" I say this, but I'm pretty sure he doesn't. If he did, I would have run into him before now. There's also something about him I never see in the boys who live around here. He's a redneck, and the way I can tell is by his manners. Redneck boys treat girls in a way that's different from regular boys. They don't act like they're scared when they get around girls, and they don't act like God's gift either. I've seen them in Florida and at North Lake Mall. They act like a girl is this neat creature that they've just discovered and want to keep around forever. "I live off over Buford Highway, but I ride my bike here sometimes," he says. "I can make it in 20 minutes. On a motorcycle, it would take 10. "Do you have a motorcycle?" "No, but I will this time next year." "How do you get the fish home?" "After I grab them, I throw them in here." He pulls a basket out of the water. It's attached to the bank by a leather thong and the biggest nail I've ever seen. I want to sit here all day and watch a boy pull fish out of the water. There's something about it that gets down inside me. Without thinking, I rock forward and reach my arm into the water just to see how cold it is, just to get the feel of it. "Want to try?" he asks. "There are water moccasins down there," I tell him. "I've seen them." I say this because it's true. "They're deeper and they feel different in the water," he says. "You get to know how the water moves. Don't stick your hand into any mud, just thrill it along the bank." I try it for a couple of minutes, but my arm aches with the cold, then starts to go numb, so I sit up again. It's nice there by the lake, cooling off some in the late afternoon. I pull my knees up to my chest and watch. "It's not going so good today," he says. "Too cold. It works best with catfish anyways. I'm just branching out." Still, he lies there with his arm in the water. "Maybe it's me," I say. "Maybe I'm a jinx. I should be going." "You? You're not a jinx." He sits up and reaches down into his boot. "See this?" he says. "It's a fillet knife. It's from Finland." I take it from him. Inside the leather sheath is what looks like the steak knives we have at home, only more dangerous, more like something a pirate would have. The blade is thin, curved up at the end, the way you think ice skate blades must look when you're up on them. A blade like that could slip right into your heart. The sheath is soft, probably worn off smooth from being carried, light cowhide, tooled arrows in triangles along its slim sides. On one end there's a whale smoking a pipe. I laugh out loud when I see it. "What's the matter?" he asks me. "That whale, look at its mouth." He puts his head over my shoulder and laughs too. "Did you know that thousands of years ago," he says, "whales left the water, came to land, then went back into the water again?" I shake my head no. "It's true," he says. "Some of them still have tiny feet buried inside their bodies. My daddy told me. He's been to Boston once and seen the aquarium." "I like this," I say, trailing my fingers along the thinnest edge of the sheath. "I have to go now, but I'm coming back on Saturday morning," he says. "You can keep it and bring it back to me then." "What if I don't come back?" "I'll hunt you up and find you." From the beginning, Tommy Waddell spoke to me this way, like I was the girl who went everywhere with him, like he always knew where I was going to be next. I take the knife back to the lake on Saturday, and Tommy Waddell is down by the dock. He smiles when he sees me, his white teeth bright in the sun. He's already caught one bream, but with a regular fishing pole, bamboo, like the ones in our garage. He holds up the fish to show me. I unsheath the knife and I keep walking toward him like that. While he's threading a piece of rope through the gills and out to the mouth, he tells me his name, tells me he lives in Doraville, is 15. Waddell Chevrolet is his uncle, Simmons Waddell, who just bought the business from Tommy's father, but is keeping him on as a salesman. He doesn't ask who I am, but I tell him anyways. "Gus for Augusta," he says. "It's nice. It suits you." People's names have a way of doing that. Simmons is a good name for my uncle. My mama says it's the face you make when you suck on a lemon, and that's just what my uncle is, that face. He takes the knife and flicks the point at the brim's eye. Then he hands the knife back along with the fish, and I do the other eye. My uncle lives with us, and my daddy hates him, but he'd never say it. He says we're going to South Carolina when things get too bad. Now it's just them all yelling. I sleep out on the roof most nights, but I don't mind. I've got candles and a mattress. It's pretty with all the stars and people's windows to look into. A couple months back, I woke up covered with snow, and I laughed so loud the neighbors got scared. By noon, we've caught four more fish, Tommy's three to my one. We're hungry, so we hide the catch and walk up to Peachtree, where it becomes Peachtree Industrial Boulevard. There's a Burger King where a friend of Tommy's works, and he gives us free Cokes. We carry our hamburgers over to Brookhaven Supply and cut behind the main building to the woodlot. "Listen to that," he yells over the noise of the saw. "It makes your teeth rattle in your head." I want to put my hands over my ears, but I close my eyes instead, and I can feel my whole body shaking, just a bag of timber, ready to be sized, bundled into matchsticks, red hot at the ends. When I open my eyes again, Tommy's looking at me with his head dipped to one side, and he's smiling. We go to sit by the curb and eat where the traffic's coming right at us. "Did you ever notice," he asks me, "how the men always drive and the women always show them where to go?" My daddy tells me that's the way it is. The rest of the afternoon, we walk, for miles, I tell myself later, through the neighborhoods near my house, then deeper into the woods that run thick along Peachtree Dunwoody, and north to Sandy Springs. Tommy has a pocket knife with two blades, a bottle opener and a can opener, and he has a skinning knife. He tells me if anything happens to us, we could cut our way out of it. Every so often we stop to rest, and Tommy whittles some. He talks about how he wants to go to Florida, get a job as a shark walker. If sharks don't keep moving, they'll die. They need people to hold leashes and keep them going. Tommy Waddell wants to be near water more than anything else in the world, except having a motorcycle. He wants to be hot all the time, to never wear shirts. Or he wants to be in planes on dangerous missions. He talks about panzers, the Blitzkrieg. He wants to know what it would be like to see the earth catch fire right under you, or fly across the Atlantic Ocean at night when there isn't anything to see but stars and planets. That's when I first think Tommy Waddell must hate gravity. When I get home, it's after 7, and I've missed supper. I say I lost track of time and I go into the bathroom, lock the door, and stare at myself in the mirror to see if I look any different. An hour earlier, when we were coming out of a creek bed, I let Tommy Waddell take my hand and keep it for a while. Next week I'll let him kiss me. I'll want him to, and when I think about that kiss, something flutters deep in my belly, a tiny hand tickling along the walls of what I think must be my womb. That spring, girls in the 7th grade are invited to sign up for ballroom dancing with the DiStefanos. I get one of the invitations in the mail, explaining how this is the first important step to junior cotillion, then the debutante societies, then cotillion. I get off by myself and look up cotillion in the dictionary. Then I write a nice note thanking the DiStefanos for thinking of me, but I did not now intend to join them. At school, my friends Noreen and Robbie Lynn can't understand why I don't want to ballroom dance. "Everybody's doing it," Noreen says. "Not everybody," I tell her. "We're all clumsy, Gus," Robbie Lynn says. "We could use a little help, learn some manners. We're all clumsy larvae, and they want to make us into social butterflies. That's all." I get this picture in my head of butterflies becoming moths, flying into lit candles and coming out with their wings singed, then sending themselves straight back into the flames. We go into the cafeteria and sit down together, at the last table by the door, like always. None of us gets a tray. Robbie Lynn takes an apple out of her coat pocket and starts to eat it. She stops when she gets to the seeds and puts it down on the table between us. "Gus," Noreen starts up again. I know. Whatever it is, I know already." We sit there, the three of us, for the rest of the lunch period. Nobody gets up and walks off. We don't hang up the phone on each other either. That's the manners we already know. That night, I dream I've swallowed the seeds out of everything in the refrigerator. Oranges, apples, cucumbers, black olives, the sesame seeds on rolls. And they all sprout inside me and send dark shoots out through my pores. A week later, I wake up telling myself I'm in love with Tommy Waddell. The afternoon before, we rode our bikes to the Peachtree DeKalb Airport, almost halfway between our houses. My father's travel agency is right next door, so we have to be careful. But we hide our bikes in the bushes, sit on the bank near the end of the runway, and watch the planes come in and go out. They're mostly private planes, and Tommy knows all their names, Cessna, Beechcraft, Piper Aztec, all sounding like words in another language. I'd reached up under his shirt to work out a kink in his back, and then he'd done the same for me. "Open your eyes," he says when he kisses me. We'd look at each other, and then there was that tiny hand again, thrilling inside me, twinging on and off, the way heat lightning looks at night, light dark, no sound at all. Nobody knows about Tommy Waddell. If they did, I have a feeling they wouldn't understand, so I keep quiet. My mother thinks I'm going around with one of the Clifton boys, the one who keeps calling. She likes it that I have secrets, as long as she knows what they are. Tommy and I don't go any place we can't get out of fast, and he doesn't call me very often. When he does, anybody who answers thinks it's just a boy from school. One night, though, the phone rings during supper. My father answers it, then hands the receiver across the table to me. "It's Tommy," the voice says. "I have to know something. I have to know if you'll die for me. I just now decided I'd die for you, and then I started thinking, and I wondered if you would too." There's a noise like his teeth are chattering. Everyone at the table is looking at me. "Yes. Yes, I would. Are you at home?" "No, this is a payphone, so I have to go. I'll be at the lake tomorrow." Then he hangs up. "Goodbye," I say to thin air. All that night I lie in bed seeing policemen and security guards with guns trying to shoot Tommy Waddell. And always I step into the path of the bullet, take the blast with my eyes wide open. Tommy Waddell tells me he loves his mother almost as much as he loves me, that she's the only other woman he'd die for. Her name is Jan Waddell, and she works for UPS. Tommy is her only child. One night I heard her tell my daddy she wanted me to learn to drive trucks. You know they make you go to school for that, to drive trucks and make boxes. My mama can make a box out of anything. You say box, and she takes out her pocket knife, zip, zip, there it is. I lie there under the pine trees by the lake, thinking I want to be like Tommy's mother. He pulls a billfold from his back pocket and takes out a picture, a snapshot of a woman at the beach, right at the edge of the water, her dress blowing out in front of her. She's looking at the camera with one hand held up to shield her eyes from the sun, so her face is mostly in shadow. Her hair is blonde, curling at the chin, and she's got Tommy's same nose, jutting away from her face like half of a perfect triangle. That's at Myrtle Beach. You can tell she's about to have a baby. She had two babies that died before I was born, not even old enough to name or get baptized. She says they're in heaven watching out for me. I know these babies aren't in heaven. They're in limbo, where babies go if they're not baptized. I don't say anything about it because it would be mean, and I have better manners than that. Manners makes me think of Noreen and Robbie Lynn ballroom dancing their way in slow circles around the clubhouse at Bagley Park right this very minute. I want to say something nice to Tommy, something to cancel out my thoughts. I'd want us to have three kids at least. Tommy tries to keep from smiling, but he doesn't do a very good job of it. He pulls a vine off the trunk of the tree we're sitting under and opens his pocket knife with one hand. "And I'd stand right there," he says, "every time, and when they said it's okay, I'd cut the cord." He slices into the vine, and then I can't help myself. "Do you know what limbo is?" He puts his arm around me and pulls me back against his chest. "Sure," he says. "It's that dance they do where you have to get from one side to the other under this stick that they keep moving closer to the ground." I can see it all in my head like a movie, the bar going lower and lower, Noreen and Robbie Lynn in their church dresses, crouching down to shimmy their hips, then finally slithering under on their backs. In May, Noreen's mother and father give her a new record player for her 13th birthday. The next Saturday afternoon, Robbie Lynn and I go over to look at it, where it sits on its little altar of milk crates in Noreen's bedroom. The first thing she does is show us how it works, how the arm slides over automatically after it feels a record's been put down on the turntable. We help her set up the speakers so that the sound will seem to come from nowhere, like there's a ghost in the room playing both treble and bass parts. Noreen's father stands in the doorway watching us, drinking a beer. When Robbie Lynn and I walked up the driveway a half hour ago, he was outside cutting the grass, and now he presses the can to his forehead and tells himself how good that feels. "I don't suppose you want any help there," he says. "No thanks," Noreen tells him. Just then I back out of the closet where I've been stacking the empty stereo boxes. "Hey there, Gus," he salutes me with the beer. "Long time no see. How's your dad?" "Good." "Me and him got to have lunch one of these days. I'm thinking about a trip to Australia."
"You are?" Noreen asks him. "When?"
"Does he handle Australia, Gus?"
"I think so, but you'd have to check."
"When are you going?" Noreen asks again.
"Oh, I don't know. Soon, later, sometime."
"Why do you want to go to Australia, Dad?"
"I don't know, except I think it would be like China without the Chinese. You know how people want to go to China because they want to know how the other half lives? Going to Australia would be like that, too."
"What's wrong with the Chinese?"
"Probably nothing, but ever since I saw that movie, The Sand Pebbles, they scare me." Noreen's father talks like this. Everything he says makes you have to ask him another question.
"What happens in The Sand Pebbles that's so scary?"
"They cut out a guy's guts while he's still alive."
It's Ray's voice. Ray is Noreen's younger brother. He's standing behind his father where we can't see him.
"That's right," Ray's father says. "They do everything with knives over there. You can't hear a knife. It makes me nervous. Anyway, Gus, tell your dad I'll be in touch."
I say I will, and he turns around, takes Ray by the shoulders, and propels him down the hall. Noreen watches them go, looks at us and starts to say something, but changes her mind. She closes the bedroom door, then kneels down in front of a stack of record albums. I know what she'll play, and I think if I have to hear American Pie all the way through one more time, I'm going to go crazy.
"How about Roberta Flack?" Robbie Lynn says.
"Get this. Manufacturer not responsible for damage to parts due to assembly, processing, shipping, handling, or user carelessness." Jesus, they should just write "so long, sucker." That's probably what the Japanese below it says,
and the French, too. Au revoir, Lacan. She's sitting on the floor at the foot of Noreen's bed reading the stereo warranty. Our French teacher worked for the resistance, and so we know some great slang. Robbie, you know I don't have any Roberta Flack, Noreen says. Just testing. Play anything, then. I don't care. How's ballroom? I ask. Noreen and Robbie Lynn look at each other. Love lies bleeding, Noreen reads. It's fine. We're learning the box step. We've been learning the box step for 3 weeks. The second class, they told us everything is really just the box step. The best part is pressing up against the boys, Robbie Lynn says. It drives them crazy. Their hands get sweaty, then their foreheads get sweaty. One kid from North Fulton sweats under his eyes so it looks like he's crying. God, I just thought of it. Maybe he is crying. There's a single knock on the door, then it opens, and Ray's standing there. He's talking to Noreen, but he's looking at Robbie Lynn. Want to play my record? What's your record? Noreen asks. He glances down at the 45 he's holding like he's forgotten what it is. The night the lights went out in Georgia, he says. Come on, Ray, Noreen says. You don't really like that, do you? It's redneck music. I do like it. It's a theme song. No, it's not. You don't even know what a theme song is. Yes, I do. It's a song that tells you everything that's going to happen. I don't care. It's still a hick redneck song. Get it out of here. Noreen, Robbie Lynn says, it won't hurt you to play it once. Let's hear it, I say. Ray's walking out the door, but when he hears our voices, he turns around again. His face has gone white, and he's shaking his head like a horse trying to get loose from its bridle. I don't need your sympathy vote, he says. Then he's looking at me. Gus probably likes that song, too, he says. She goes around with rednecks, her and her redneck boyfriend riding around on their bikes. Then he slams the door shut. Noreen and Robbie Lynn are staring at me now that they've finished looking at the door where one of the hinges has come loose. What's he talking about? Noreen asks. I have no idea, I say, looking her right in the eye. In early June, the night isn't so filled up with crickets and bats and starlings crying in their sleep, so you notice sounds, where they come from, and how long they last. You notice how the calliope music of the good humor truck, when it comes by after dinner, doesn't ever seem to get farther away until all at once it's just gone. You hear the differences in kids' mothers' voices calling them home. Tonight I can hear that Skiff Wager and his sister Ellie are still outside in the street long after I've gone to bed, and I know they're doing wheelies on their spider bikes. I hear their voices catch in their throats as they pull up on the handlebars and then the plomp of the front tire as it touches down. It's the same noise all my muscles make when they finally ease down and let me sleep. It sounds like a body falling overboard. Then I'm awake again, sure I hear him coming when he's still in the next yard. Something makes me sit up in bed and hold myself perfectly still. In a few minutes, I see a shadow outside the window, and he whispers my name. I go to the screen, and Tommy Waddell's voice rushes in at me, along with the smell of gardenias, like both are billowing out of his mouth at the same time. Can you come out? He says. I have to tell you something. I unhook the screen and sit with my legs hanging outside the window. Tommy's standing in front of me with his hands on my knees. Even this close, he's just a shadow with skin. I ask him what's wrong. They decided tonight, he says. We're moving to Spartanburg at the end of the month. Me and my mama are supposed to go earlier. I don't want him to say anything else, and he doesn't. He turns and leans his back into my chest, and I wrap my arms around his bony shoulders. We stay that way for a long time. I think I've fallen asleep, and then I'm not sure, because I look around and nothing's changed. The same stars twitch over our heads, only Tommy's turned around again, and he's looking at my face. I don't know how much of it he can see. Twice he turns toward the neighbor's yard, listening for a dog's bark or a voice, and I see his profile, his hard jaw, his hair like straw, lifting off his head in the breeze and settling down again. I tell him he has to go, and in my head the words sound like tiny switches being flipped off. When I see Tommy the next day, I can tell he hasn't been to sleep. We're down by the lake, and I let him lie with his head in my lap. All's I can think of, he tells me, is this thing that happened to me in third grade. One day the teacher comes in for our Georgia history lesson, and she's telling us about names. The one part I remember is that all the Peachtree streets weren't Peachtree at first. They were Pitchtree because of all the pitch pines around here. After that, I felt like I didn't know where I was. All us kids felt that way. I was just learning the names of streets and getting my bearings, and whoosh, it's all different. I know it doesn't matter. I know they're all Peachtree now, but I had to think about everything all over again, make a whole new map in my head. Tommy has his eyes closed, so he can't see me nodding my head, but I'm sure he feels my body moving, the muscles in my belly going up and down. School lets out, and then for 2 weeks after that, Tommy and I are quiet together, sitting down by the lake every day we can. We talk about what we'll give each other before he goes, and we decide to trade clothes. I'm going to give him everything that might fit, and he's going to do the same. Every day around noon, we talk about hiking out to Burger King again, and then I get to feel that standing up would put us too far apart, so we never go. In the evening, I eat 3 helpings of supper and then sit outside, leaning up against the fence between our property and the golf course. I wait for him to come back at night and tell me he isn't really going, that he'll stay here, move into one of the half-built houses down the street. I'll take care of him, bring him the food my mother makes. We'll find some way to keep him warm in the winter. I've seen a movie about a boy who lives in the crawl space of a house owned by people he doesn't know, and when they discover him, they're good and kind. My thoughts go on like this until it gets dark, and then I realize he isn't coming back tonight, and I stay out a little longer, just in case. When I go in to kiss my parents goodnight, my father's suitcase is lying open on their bed. In it are shoes and shirts a color blue I've never seen anywhere else in the world. There's a bottle of gin and his shaving kit that opens like an old woman's change purse, the kind you have to squeeze like you're crumpling up paper. "Where are you going?" I ask him. "Oh, Gus, there you are. Baltimore, just for 2 days, back before you know I'm gone." That was what he always said, and sometimes it was true. In the morning, my mother kisses him goodbye, then circles the day on the calendar, the day he'll be back. She goes in to make the bed, and I think she must be putting her hands in the sheets to find out where he's been. The day before he's supposed to leave with his mother, Tommy Waddell meets me by the lake. I feel almost like I don't want to touch him, but then I do. He's holding a knife his father's just given him, one for dressing deer. "It's only a loan," he says. "He wants it back when he gets to Spartanburg, but I'll tell him I lost it in the move. I think you should keep it." It's a buck knife, says so on the sheath. It's a name I'll remember years later because I'll still have it. "I'll never not know where this is," I tell him. "I can't talk right." "I want to show you how sharp it is," Tommy says. He lays me down next to him. I want him to tell me not to worry, it isn't going to hurt, but he doesn't say these things. He unzips my jeans, and I think that whatever he's going to do, it's what I want. He leaves the jeans open on my hips and pulls down the elastic of my underpants, just a little, just below the line where the dark hairs start. With the knife's edge, he shaves away a few of these hairs, leaving a tiny stroke of white skin that waits, then blossoms red. "You might have a scar there," he says, "and you might not. I'll be back to check." Tommy Waddell didn't come back, not once. And though it's years later, I still think about him and how maybe he was the only true one. Even today, talking to Noreen and Robbie Lynn, I said, "There was a boy once, but I didn't finish, and they didn't ask."
The greatest thing you'll ever learn is just to love and be loved in return.
Yeah.
That was Liza Whelan reading Tommy Waddell. And as we heard, it's mainly about a coming-of-age teenage girl and how she falls in love with a 16-year-old by the name of Tommy Waddell. From the very beginning, with wonderful descriptions and authentic dialogue, tonight's author gets us into the head, the emotions, the language, the thinking, and the lifestyle of this teenager who turns out to be the lead character in the story. As the story progresses, we feel that we get to know her, her parents, her fellow students at school, and of course her boyfriend, Tommy Waddell. Day after day and month after month, because of the realistic dialogue and vivid descriptions by the author, we're more and more drawn into this young couple's affair. And wasn't it quite a shock when, at the end of the story, we learn that Tommy Waddell is going to be moving and that she'll probably never see him again. Friends, Liza Whelan is a talented novelist, short story writer, and poet who for quite a few years taught creative writing as well as English at Fresno State University. She received a fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts, the Christopher Isherwood Foundation, and the North Carolina Arts Council. On two separate occasions, her work has been awarded the Distinguished Pushcart Prize. Some years ago, it was my good fortune to have her as an instructor when I was a student at Fresno State, and I can attest to her excellent teaching and writing skills. We certainly want to thank her for that wonderful story tonight and hope we can air more of her fiction on future programs. And so we come to the close of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read story again, just get online at kvpr.org and click on to Valley Writers Read. Next week, our author will be C.B. Mosier. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio, produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.